Hello again. We're back on the air. This is Radio Entrepreneurs. My name is Jeffrey Davis, and I want to thank our friends over at The Social Scene and MTP Software. They are our hosts and have been our hosts for the good part of 2016. I just want to remind everybody, my co-host today is Peter Myerson from the law firm of Cohn, Rasnick, Myerson & Plout. Hi, Peter.
It's always good to be here, Jeff, and I'm glad I'm not forgotten.
No, never forgotten. Missed many times, but
missed a lot. Okay.
Our next guest, I know Chris. Chris says it was foaming at the mouth waiting for you to get in here today, making sure that I'd behave. Denise McWilliams from the New England Innocence Project, and it didn't say the, but I added that on. Sorry.
That's perfectly acceptable. Good morning.
Good morning. Denise, tell us about the New England Innocence Project.
Well, the New England Innocence Project was founded about 16, 17 years ago, and our mission is to identify and represent innocent people who have been wrongfully convicted of crime.
How did you get involved in this?
Honestly, my background is HIV, AIDS, and LGBT civil rights, and I've worked in that field for about 32 years. Then I got to the point that I was looking for a new challenge where I could take the lessons I learned in those areas and bring them into a new area. I had done criminal law in the past. I enjoyed it, and this just seemed to be a good fit.
Is it very prevalent?
It's more prevalent than it should be. We don't have great figures on how prevalent it actually is. If you look at the DNA convictions or the DNA exonerations, you will see that about 2.5 to 3% of all convictions are probably wrongful convictions. But that's a very small subset of people who get convicted. The estimates are that the actual wrongful conviction rate probably goes somewhere between 5 and 10%. And that includes people who have pled out because they believe they're going to get a better deal that way.
That's a pretty stunning statistic.
It's a frightening one.
Yeah.
All of us are taught in law school, there's a truism, I think it's from Blackstone, that it is better for 10 guilty people to go free than one innocent person to be convicted. And sadly, that's simply not the truth.
So, I don't know that we need to explore, nor that we have the time to explore, you know, why people get convicted wrongly. I mean, there are a million reasons. But so how do you end up taking on clients? I mean, give me an example of how the process works.
We have a fairly exhaustive screening process. We have a detailed written application that people have to submit. Those questionnaires are reviewed by my entire staff, and we make two determinations, one of which, does this actually seem as if this person could be innocent? And if so, is there a way of proving it? At that point, we go out and we find all the related material that we can, media reports, court decisions, we speak to the attorneys involved, we pull the trial transcripts. And if it gets through that next level of review, we then assign the cases to law students who go through the transcripts of the trial and pull out all the information available. And only then do we make the decision that this is a case we should move forward.
So you vet these pretty carefully.
We take fewer than 4% of the applications we get to move forward.
How big a staff do you have?
Not big enough. I have one full-time staff attorney. I have a case director who's a very experienced and talented paralegal. And I have an operations / communication person. We depend heavily on volunteer interns, both undergraduates and law students.
Is it hard to find them?
People love this work. This is the sort of work that people just feel gives meaning to all of their education and all of their training. So we're very fortunate to have a rich pool of volunteers to pull from.
How do you fund this?
Precariously.
well, I assume that.
Historically, our operations have been funded primarily by the donations of attorney's fees from attorneys who successfully win compensation cases of the wrongfully incarcerated. We are now beginning to rev up trying to attract more private donors because although the attorney fee cases are nice, they're not predictable. And they're not regular enough to actually sustain our operations. So we are now really looking to the community to help support our work.
Does any of the bar associations give you any money or give you any support?
No. I mean, well, they give us support. And the bar associations are very strong allies because they have accepted the fact that we all have an interest in making sure that justice is done. Because people are entitled to a criminal defense attorney if they can't afford one, at least up into a jury trial, the bar associations historically have devoted their philanthropic giving to poverty civil issues. So there's not a lot of funds available for the type of work we do at this point.
That's interesting. So, you know, does it make you feel bad when you can't take certain cases?
Oh, it's heartbreaking. Because you look at people who have just spent 5, 10, 15, 20 years in prison, and I have a gut sense that this person is an innocent person, but there's simply no way I can bring that case forward, or if I do bring the case forward, it's going to be another 2 or 3 years.
Wow. It's really a tough, you know, nut to swallow.
Oh, yeah, it's painful.
You know, so do you see doing this forever, or...?
Well, I'm probably getting a little too close to retirement to be using the word forever.
These people are wrongly incarcerated. Are they also wrongly treated once they're incarcerated, too?
Depends.
Is there a correlation?
Depends. For our folks who have been convicted of a sexually related assault, it can be pretty vicious. One of my board members was convicted of a series of rapes that DNA subsequently proved he was innocent. He was slashed across the back of his neck when he was trying to get a drink of water one day. One of our clients, who is now deceased, unfortunately, was exonerated when he had been convicted in the daycare craziness of the early 80s. He was a gay man, and he was pretty brutalized throughout his incarceration. So it's not a pretty picture.
Sad.
It's very sad. It's tragic. You know, you take people who, through no fault of their own, have their own lives totally disrupted, and then they are tortured. And even then, when they get out, there's no services available for them. Many of them still have to face the stigma of having spent that much time in prison. And they've lost a huge chunk of their lives. And there are just things we don't know, we don't realize that we have learned over time. Again, my board member, he was incarcerated for 19 years. The day he was released, his attorney said to him, "So, you know, what can I get you? This is your first day of freedom." And his response was, "You know, I keep hearing about this thing called Starbucks. Could I have a Starbucks?" And, you know, to us, Starbucks is ubiquitous. But to somebody who's just coming out after 18 years, it's, you know, a Rip Van Winkle experience.
Well, I would imagine there would be a lot of Rip Van Winkle experiences, you know, if you're put away for 20 years.
Yeah, there absolutely are.
You know, so.
And I think about what it's like to just be in the, be institutionalized like that. These places are not pleasant.
No, under the best of circumstances, they're not pleasant. And the problem, too, is particularly for folks who are incarcerated when they are younger. You know, the social skills and the interpersonal skills they acquire are the ones that are suited for living in a prison. You know, so when they come out, there's a whole level of social maturation that they, again, have to go through to be successful.
Is there any compensation? I mean, I know there's a statute that allows people to seek compensation if they've been wrongfully convicted.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, does that work?
In a way, yes. The problem with this, there's several problems with the statute, though admittedly it was a good first step. One of the problems, it can take 2 to 4 years before somebody can see any money from that type of a lawsuit. The problem is when folks get out, they have nothing. If they're fortunate, they have a family who will support them. If they're not, they're on their own. Many of these people aren't eligible for public benefits. They don't have the work skills necessary to get a job. So they have an immediate reentry problem that this statute simply doesn't address.
Why aren't they entitled to, you know, welfare benefits?
Because by and large, welfare benefits are not, most of our clients are single men. They're single men who are not disabled. And that's a tough population for public assistance. I also, and I could be wrong in this, I also think they have a harder time getting access to health insurance, even through the MassHealth connector, because although they could probably do it if they could pay the premium, for most of these folks, they're not able to afford the premium.
And I assume that they have trouble getting jobs even though they've been exonerated?
Yeah. Some of our clients do very well. The gentleman who was slashed across the neck, he was attached to the Green Berets at Fort Devens when he was arrested. He was a diesel mechanic. And fortunately, diesel engineering apparently is one of those traits that you can actually pick back up again pretty quickly. He was very fortunate in landing a job within 2 months of getting out. But he was the rare story.
Interesting. I mean, a diesel engine today is the same diesel engine it was 30 years ago.
No, it's much better. No, because you know you can buy like a German car with diesel engines, and it's a performance car.
Yes,
but it wasn't a performance car 30 years ago.
Yes,
but the fundamentals.
Fundamental engineering is the same. I agree.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about just how affected they are emotionally and psychologically for life.
One of the odd things that I experienced was that many of the folks I met who had been exonerated were just amazing people. They bore no bitterness. Again, this gentleman.
Like Mandela.
Exactly. This gentleman, the person who was his prosecutor, asked to meet him at the courthouse to apologize for his role in the wrongful conviction. And my client said, of course, that's fine. And when he came up and asked for his forgiveness, the response was, you did the best you could under the circumstances, that this wasn't your fault.
It does remind me of Mandela, because I went to South Africa, and I've been to the Apartheid Museum. I've been to Mandela's house, and it's just unbelievable to see, you know, what happened to him, and he came out with so much love.
Well, the depth of character that most of these folks have is really, it's humbling. And I spoke at one point to Barry Sheck, who was basically the gentleman who started the whole ball rolling, and asked him, you know, what is the deal here? All these people are kind, they're patient, they're forgiving. What is this? And his response was, if they're not like that, they don't make it through.
Well, I just, the time. Denise, just a compelling story, and I hope you come back again. But if somebody wants to get hold of you and support the New England Innocence Project, how would they find you?
We are at www.newenglandinnocence.org, or they can contact me directly at dmcwilliams, and I have an unbearable email address, at newenglandinnocence.org.
Thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It's a great story.
Continued success, hopefully.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Davis. I'm with Peter Meyerson from the law firm of Cohn, Rasnick, Meyerson & Plaut. That's Peter's from that firm, not me. I'm from Mage. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on Radio Entrepreneurs.